Hi, everyone, and welcome to our panel discussion on COVID-19 vaccinations. First, I'd like to briefly introduce our panelists, first starting with Dr. Michael Eden. Dr. Eden is the former Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer of Allergy and Respiratory Research at Pfizer, and among his qualifications, he holds a PhD in pharmacology. Our next guest is Dr. Michael Palmer. Dr. Palmer is a board-certified medical microbiologist and medical doctor with a focus on pharmacology. Dr. Palmer is also an associate professor of chemistry at the University of Waterloo. And joining us shortly is Dr. Sutrit Bhakti. Dr. Bhakti is a medical microbiologist and medical doctor and professor emeritus of medical microbiology and immunology. I want to welcome all of you to the stream. Now, first, I am going to pose a question to all of you, and you could respond with about 2 to 3 minutes. And I'd like to ask you about, of course, the COVID-19 vaccines and safety. So earlier today, we heard from all of you on the science behind the COVID-19 vaccines. But can you please tell us, the viewers, what is the most important message that you would like to share with the public on vaccinations? And Dr. Michael Eden, I will begin with you.
Yes, hello. I'm going to have to play for time for a moment while I think about that most important message. So, as I say, generally, being of the pharmaceutical industry, I favour vaccines and all sorts of novel medicines. Of course I do. It's been my life, not vaccines, but other new medicines. These COVID-19 vaccines are of a completely different nature, and they have not been adequately characterised as regards performance, either on efficacy or safety. And I would say because your government has lied to you about the extent of a public health emergency from this allegedly new virus, and they have definitely lied and suppressed all sorts of useful pharmaceutical treatments. And because there are severe toxicities associated in some people with these vaccines, I would say my message is don't accept it.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Eden. Dr. Michael Palmer, I would now like to turn to you. What is the most important message that you would like the viewers to take home regarding COVID-19 vaccines?
Well, I would say that these vaccines are not needed in the first place. That is one of the most important things. It was actually clear before even the first vaccine was rolled out that there was no need for them. Mike already talked about that as well. The mortality numbers simply didn't justify any kind of emergency authorization. That is the first thing. The second thing is that there are clearly alternatives available. The disease is treatable. It just was not properly treated. And this was one of the tricks that was used to goose up the fear of the disease. Denial of treatment needlessly inflated the casualty count. And even with these measures, the numbers of fatalities were not high enough to justify any of these vaccines. And then another point is these gene-based vaccines, there is a reason why they have never been approved for use in humans, even though the idea has been around for decades. It's not a new idea. It's an idea that any undergraduate student who pays a little bit attention could come up with. It is not a smart idea. It is actually a pretty silly idea. My initial reaction when I first heard about it, the so-called invention of DNA vaccines was, what a stupid idea. And indeed, it is a stupid idea. And I'm not going to go into the technical reasons for that assessment. But as long as reasonable standards of safety and medical ethics in general remained in force, none of these vaccines was approved, and only in the context of the completely artificial narrative of danger and the complete debasement of medical ethics and medical standards were these vaccines approved using this emergency pretext. I think that tells you all you need to know about the safety of these things. Thank you.
Thank you. And Dr. Bhakti, I would like to ask you, as I ask the other two panelists, what is the most important message that you would like to share with the public on COVID-19 vaccination? Dr. Bhakti, we will return to you shortly. I will turn it over now to Dr. Michael Eden. Dr. Eden, can you... Oh, Dr. Eden, can you explain for us the risk benefit to contracting COVID-19 versus receiving or versus receiving the vaccine?
That's a good question. There's some slight difficulty in answering that because unfortunately there's been a great deal of reliance placed on untrustworthy PCR tests. But I think just referring to the work of Dr. John Ioannidis, who's probably one of the foremost epidemiologists working in the world today. And I think his assessment is that the overall, what's called infection fatality ratio, what proportion of a perfectly representative population, a large population, perfectly representative of the population, if they were all infected, what fraction would die? And it's about 0.15%. So I think that's 1.5 in 1,000, so 3 people in 2,000 and so on. Now, you don't want, obviously, we don't want people to die, but death is an inevitability, as someone recently said. As you get older, the probability that you'll reach your next birthday reduces. If you didn't know that, you've not been paying attention. So I check my numbers. I'm 61 in reasonable health. I probably got about a 99% chance in normal life of making 62. There's a 1% chance I won't make it, you know, also all-cause mortality. So seen in that light, 0.15 is about a tenth of the annual risk that I'm running, as you see here. And then the median age of the people who die, so the most common age in my country, the United Kingdom, was 84 years for women who died with COVID, and I think it was 81 for males. And that's interesting because it's actually slightly higher than the average, the median age at death of men and women in the UK from all other causes. I remember when I first saw that data, you know, I thought, well, that means there can't really be an important pandemic because a disease that causes death, it doesn't cause it earlier than you would otherwise have died. You can't really say it's kind of killed people really incrementally to what would have happened. And if it had killed more people, it would have lowered the median age at death, and it hasn't. So it's, bottom line is, I do think people of advanced age, basically the people who are most likely to get ill and die, are the people who are close to the end of their lives anyway, by virtue of advanced age and the possession of usually 2 to 3 chronic illnesses like diabetes or cancer or hypertension. So those people, they might run, I don't know exactly, but they might run a similar risk from the vaccine. The numbers, I think, are somewhere, I don't know, 1 in 10,000. Maybe it's more or less. It depends on the proportion of real adverse events that get reported. We know it's low, but I don't know if it's 1% or 10%. So, you know, if the vaccines worked, then there might be a case to make for using them in the most vulnerable people. But I don't even believe that. I wish I could. I don't even believe that. And certainly anyone younger, the probability that you'll sicken and die with this virus is so small and diminishes extremely rapidly with reducing age. If you go down to 70 and 60, 50, 40, 30, the percentage of people who will get sick and die who are in good health at these younger ages is so low that I'm afraid the risk from the vaccine is greater than the risk from the virus. And I did do a back of the cigarette packet calculation, which was difficult to do in relation to children. And I looked at the data from the UK, and there were so few children in previously good health. I don't think there were any under the age of 13. And so I adopted the sort of average mortality, that is looking at the public adverse event reporting systems. And I came up with a rough calculation of something like, if you vaccinate all the children in the UK, you will have 50 times more of them killed by the vaccine than the virus. Now, it's a big claim. It just needs to be, I mean, it's absurd, isn't it? Even if it was twice as many, you just wouldn't do it. So whether it's 20 or 50 or 100, it's just literally absurd. The children in my country and probably everywhere else, if you vaccinate all of them, you know the statistics already. You can look at the public data. Children generally don't catch the virus. They don't get particularly symptomatic. It's extraordinarily unlikely that they get ill enough to go to hospital. I think in Sweden, for example, they did not close their primary schools ever and they had a few admissions. These are all causes, so people who include some people who tragically would just die. And they didn't have a single COVID-associated death in the child, not in the whole period. But I think if you vaccinated all the children of Sweden, I'm afraid a small number would die directly as a result of these sort of random and severe adverse events. And I've said this to people, that if you do this, if you mandate mass vaccination of children in your territory, I'm afraid I'm going to call you a murderer, because I've just told you that the risk of dying from the virus is so slight, there isn't a risk to reduce. But the risk of being injured by the product, albeit relatively small, is monstrous compared with that risk. And if you go ahead, I'm afraid that's murder, because I know what the outcome's going to be. Anyway, I hope that was useful.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Eden. And Dr. Bakhti, while we are on the subject of risk-benefit analysis when it comes to receiving the vaccine versus contracting COVID-19, can you explain briefly and in layperson terms some of the dangers associated with receiving the COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, first of all, I agree entirely with everything that Mike Eden just said. I have no more to add to that. I did try to outline on the flip chart why I am horrified by the thought that anyone is going to repeat the vaccination and get a second and third shot. Because now that these facts are printed out, everyone can read these papers. They are clear as day, and they are absolutely conclusive. We know that if you dare to take the second shot, you are inviting and demanding of your immune system, the total immune system, not only the killer lymphocytes that are there to fight the viruses, but also the complement system that is actually there to fight bacteria. I like to compare this with the Air Force and the Navy. And there is no other disease or illness where both Air Force and Navy are mobilized. Now, what we're doing is we're doing this experiment on millions of humans. This cannot be. And that's why, to come to the first question that you said, my plea is that people just stop. Don't quarrel with each other, but stop the vaccination first and think. And let's sit down at a table and talk to each other like civilized people to see who is right and who is wrong. Not both sides. Both sides cannot be right. It cannot be that the vaccine is safe and efficacious, but that the vaccine is dangerous and not efficacious. So for the sake of humanity, for the sake of mankind, we, the scientists, the doctors, have the damn duty to sit down and talk to each other.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Bakhti. Dr. Palmer, I saw you several times throughout the comments shaking your head. What are some of the dangers of receiving the COVID-19 vaccine, and why is it important that we stop vaccinating children?
One key concern that really is very grave is fertility. At this point, we really have no data. We can, on no grounds, rule out grave damage to fertility. And there are several possible avenues to that final effect. One of them is the toxicity of these cationic lipids, which are an important part of the lipid mixtures in the lipid nanoparticles. And these have been designed in such a manner as to persist in our bodies for a very long time. You may have heard, for example, of DDT, that is an insecticide, right, used against malaria, for example, right, to kill off the malaria-transmitting anopheles bugs. These can persist in our bodies almost indefinitely. They simply hide away in fat droplets, in fat tissues, in other organs. And these cationic lipids, they are indeed only very weakly ionic, only very weakly charged. They are very lipid, very fat-soluble. And they very well may persist in our bodies in the very same manner. And if they do so, if after you get one shot, if 3 months later, let's say 50% of that is still around in your fat cells, in the fat droplets, in the ovaries, in other hormone-producing cells, then you vaccinate again. you get a fresh top up of this. You will simply accumulate these toxic compounds over time. And this, as it is now shaping up, right, the narrative is shaping up in such a way that we will have to get a new top up, a new vaccination for every bloody silly variant, even if it only has a minuscule deviation from the original sequence. The immunology of this is complete nonsense. Okay, I think Sucharit will probably concur with this. Mike will concur with this, but maybe you ask him for the input. This is just a pretext. This is the way it looks to me. This is a pretext for applying these poisonous compounds with such a high frequency that the inevitable result will be cumulative toxicity, accumulation of these poisons in the bodies of our children and of young adults. And they might very well be rendered infertile due to these harmful effects. This is one grave concern I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer. Dr. Eden, I know several months ago we spoke and you said to me that one of your greatest concerns was the use of top-up COVID-19 vaccines to combat the different variants. Can you elaborate on that as it relates to what's happening today with this new Delta variant?
Yes, I certainly can. I must say, when the penny dropped for me, I think, towards the end of last year, and I'm embarrassed in retrospect that the penny didn't drop in the summer of last year, because I don't think I learned anything new. That basically, you know, the government's lied to you and they're still lying to you. They brought forward at great speed these materials that are not necessary and are dangerous. And, you know, you cannot conclude, folks, anyone listening to this, I've spent 40 years training and practice in life science. I've no incentive whatsoever to make this stuff up. So what I'm telling you is true, that you're being misled, and it's frightening, that there's a reason for it. And of course, I don't have a copy of the plot, so I don't know exactly what they want to do. But as Michael Palmer just mentioned, that the variant story is being is made to do a lot of work, should we say. I looked, Dr. Sin Lee is a very well-known molecular biologist, and I looked at a report he had written, and just slightly increment my numbers. I have in the past said that these variants, I call them samients, because they're almost identical to the original. I think Sucharit earlier said that these, the way these this virus mutates, it does so what we call antigenic drift. It just slowly changes its genetic sequence. And it really is slow. It's now 18 months, and I think it's about 0.5% now. It's 0.3. I counted some extra changes. That's if you include changes everywhere in the virus, not just the spike. So it's about 0.3% a year. My God, I can tell you, even in 10 years, 3% change would be way too small to escape our immune system. I would say at this linear rate, 100 years. By 100 years, I would be worried about really serious immune escape. But up to that point, as Sucharit described, by the time your immune system has been educated, because it's been exposed to, you know, one version of this virus, it's taken, as I describe it, it takes lots of high-resolution pictures of all the different pieces of the virus it's cut it up into. And so when you see a variant, given it's almost identical, your body cuts it up again and examines all the pieces. Almost all the pieces are still identical because the amount of change is tiny. Naturally, your T lymphocytes mostly have still recognized the bits they memorized before, and they'll perfectly defend you. So when I hear, say, the chief scientific officer of UK, a former colleague 30 years ago, just telling you that, you know, you might need top-ups for these variants, I just think, I know you don't believe that, because you know the same books I did. You trained in the same university system in the same years as I did. You had the same set texts. It's the same, you know, immunology 101. What are you doing? So the bottom line is, you definitely don't need top-up vaccines for any of these wretched variants. And I can tell you, and there are papers you can look up, where someone took white cells from people's blood who had survived COVID. Most people do, of course. And what they did is they isolated these T cells and they threw what I will describe as the Wuhan sequence, or at least a protein mix from the Wuhan sequence. And yes, of course, they all responded to it because they had immune memory. And then they took proteins, peptides, proteins, samples, essentially, of all the variants that they had to date at the time. I think it was about four of them. And sure enough, the T cells responded just as well to every single one of those variants because they're almost identical. They have to do that, and they did do that. But hats off to them, they did the work and published it. And they, so there's no question whatever, no question. It's not speculation. It's not my opinion. It's actually demonstrated. So theoretically, you would be defended, and they've demonstrated in practice you are defended. So what the hell is the pharmaceutical industry doing lying, telling you you need these boosters? What the hell is in those vials? It's not possible that it can be another vaccine because you don't need one. And so I drew the conclusion that there must be something else. And so I would say to people, do not take third and subsequent vaccines. They cannot be necessary immunologically. You must ask yourself, what is going on and what are they injecting in me? I won't go any further than that at this point, but I'm very worried about that.
Thank you. This was a very informative discussion. I want to thank our panelists, Dr. Michael Palmer, Dr. Sutrit Bhakdi, and Dr. Michael Yeadon.